Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Squanderlust, the podcast about the emotional side of money, why our actions aren't always as good as our intentions, and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Martha Lawton. Today, I'm talking to debut novelist Alia Ali Afzal about the emotive topic of financial infidelity. Her novel, Would I Lie to You, tells the story of Faiza, whose secret spending has got out of control, endangering her family, her home, and her marriage. It is a gripping read. Now, I was given a proof copy, so, you know, this is a gifted episode, but this has not affected how I feel about this at all. It is a really exciting, really fun book. So, really looking forward to this conversation. Before we start, I just want to give you a reminder that there are lots of ways you can stay in touch with us at Squanderlust between episodes. If you ever feel like you want to talk to us about something in the show, you can. We are all over social media at Squanderlust Pod, and we have a group in the Good Pods app where you can chat to me and other listeners about the emotional side of money and how we can change our financial habits for the better. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome, Alia. Tell our listeners a bit about yourself.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you so much. So as you said, my debut novel is coming out in 4 weeks, in fact, on July 8th. It's called Amazing. Would I Lie to You? I'm really excited. As you said, it's about a woman called Faiza who has secretly spent her family's emergency savings. And when her husband, Tom, suddenly loses his job, she has to replace the money quickly before he discovers the truth. I came a little bit late to writing. I always loved to read and write, but I never really thought about writing a novel till my late 40s. So it's a really exciting opportunity for me. But when I think about it, you know, everything that I've done in my life has been getting me to this point because I'm really fascinated by people and what makes them tick. I worked for 18 years as an executive career coach, an MBA coach in the city and for business schools. And a lot of my sessions, as well as being, you know, focused on the career stuff, were also about the emotional aspects of work and often money as well, which kind of seems to go hand in hand often. And before that, I studied Russian and German at university, which was also a way to really connect to different cultures and literature. And again, I'm fascinated by the study of human nature and what makes us do the things that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. So am I. So am I. Would not be doing this show if I didn't find us weirdo human beings to be completely fascinating, myself included, equally a weirdo human being. So we're going to do, as far as possible, a kind of spoiler-free discussion of the story.
Yes, please.
Yes. I will also say, even though we're recording this prior to release date, it will be coming out probably afterwards. And I should really mention, because I forgot at the head of the show, that we are remote recording this. So apologies to our listeners briefly about if there are any glitches or sound quality issues, that's what's going on here. But to get back to this, so what was the inspiration for this story?
So I was really interested to come across, you know, your podcast and the work that you do, because I think my inspiration stemmed a lot from this fascination with money and how money seems to be such a taboo subject. And especially these days, you know, when people will talk about absolutely anything and put absolutely anything on social media. And yet money is just such a funny topic that we are so coy about. So that really fascinated me. And the inspiration was personal as well, because, you know, in my relationship with money and in my personal relationship, you know, in my marriage, my husband and I have really opposite approaches to money. So, you know, which can have its own interesting storylines as well, I can tell you.
Yes, so, I'm familiar with this.
unfortunately or fortunately, I'm the spender and he's the saver. We've always been like this. And, you know, I'm always the one who's saying, you know, oh my goodness, we need to, you know, go on that holiday before we get too old to enjoy it. And we can put it on a card and think about it later. And he's always the one saying, yeah, but, you know, what are we going to live on if we live to be 80? And so we're completely opposite. And the interesting thing about that is that, you know, we never talked about this. We know when we were dating, when we got together, and we've been married a long time, and our perspective, you know, and our approach to money hasn't really changed. So that kind of really fascinated me, you know, on a personal level as well. And the fact that this is such a taboo subject.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I relate to that definitely, because in spite of the fact that it's my job to understand money and to teach people how to use money better, and to explain all these kind of tips and tricks, and I learn so much about money and our mindset, I'm certainly, my sort of basic inclination is often towards overspending. And my husband is incredibly rational about money. Just his, he's very much a sort of, I wouldn't say he's an underspending type at all. He's not, he's not sort of tight in any way, but he's very much somebody who sets a goal and works towards it. Which is, you know, whereas I tend to be a little bit more loose around this kind of thing. Although that, you know, has changed, I think. And in part working on this podcast, I've talked about it being a kind of commitment mechanism for me in the past, where I sort of have to live up to the standards that I'm talking about in public. So it actually really helps me to do this. But yeah, no, I do totally understand. And it can be one of these things that if you don't talk about it, it becomes a source of tension where there is no other tension. It can be really challenging. Yeah.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think my husband is also what I would call rational. And I think that's one thing I noticed, that he could be very clear-headed about money, whereas I had certain emotional sort of attachments towards it, and my response tended to be emotional. And so I totally recognize, you know, the rationality versus the irrationality of just feeling this rush, which is, I came to understand, you know, was leading a lot of my spending. And interestingly enough, similarly to you, I found that writing this book has actually been an incredible tool for me to examine my relationship with money, and also, you know, how it plays out in our relationship. And I still hate talking about money. I absolutely hate it. We do not talk about it. However, I'll tell you, when I was talking through plot lines with my husband, it was an amazing opportunity to do it kind of through Faizah and Tom, so that it's not personal to us. And and I hope actually others can maybe use it in the same way.
No, I think that's really good. And it does, I think you can see in the book to some extent how money can be used as a tool for control in some ways, even if somebody isn't controlling, even somebody doesn't intend to be controlling. You know, I'm not talking about sort of economic abuse or people who are trying to control somebody else through money in a negative way, but just even somebody who seems to be rational and goal oriented can, in fact, in some ways be quite controlling because the structure, the rationality, the goal setting is itself a kind of control. And when they get, if something knocks them off plan, you know, there can be quite a strong reaction to that. So I think it's, it's not always obvious. I think when somebody's overspending it, it can seem really obvious where the emotion is and where the not necessarily rational behavior is, but that's not the only place it lives.
No. And I think you're absolutely right. And that control, that rational approach also comes from somewhere, and it meets a need inside somebody to feel secure. So maybe underlying it all, there is some kind of emotional root to that as well. And and I think the tension and conflict in relationships can come when, you know, in each person's mind, they're not really doing anything wrong, but the other person just can't understand the other person's point of view. And that's, you know, some of the tension in the book as well. And, you know, when you were asking me also about inspirations, I found, you know, that I tend to be sort of the friend in the group that everyone tells their secrets to.
Ooh.
And it was really fascinating to me. So I would be going, say, meeting a group of friends for lunch or for dinner, and somebody would pull me aside and tell me some terrible problem they were having, perhaps with money, or they'd lost their job, or they, you know, some, and then we'd go into the dinner and they would just pretend to be very happy and not mention it to anyone else. And similarly with my job, because as a career coach, you know, our sessions are a very confidential space. So people feel comfortable opening up to me about things like money and money problems and conflicts around money. So I began to see that, yes, I had an experience of this, but it was an experience many people shared, and very few talked about it. It was seen almost as shameful, or like we said, a taboo. And that also kind of prompted me to kind of explore this topic in my book, because I didn't understand, when it's such a huge part of our lives and impacts everything, why we are so, unwilling to talk about it or open up about it.
Yeah, I think one of the things I really enjoyed reading the book was not just the issues of Faiza and Tom and their relationship to money and how that played out between them, but also all of the lesser characters, the minor characters, not lesser, but the non-main characters and their tensions and the strange ways that money was used as a proxy for something else in their relationships, for example. That you're not just giving one perspective on how money can play out in family dynamics. There's a whole range of stories explored here.
As well as the relationship dynamics, I also wanted to look at, you know, how money empowers you or otherwise just in your lives. And a lot of the women in the book are stay-at-home mums. And, you know, the power dynamic in their relationship has suddenly flipped. These were all professional women, and they used to have their own disposable income. And when that goes, there is that loss of control almost in that as well, and loss of agency in a way for them. And I wanted to look at that as well. And it's really interesting because, in a way, they become defined by their husband's jobs and the houses that they can afford because of their husbands and their husband's status. And I found this quite interesting. You know, I'm doing an MA in creative writing as well. And also I love reading the classics. And I was thinking about it that, you know, do these women in London, in present day London in 2021, are their economic situations really that different for, say, somebody in Jane Austen times? Because it seems to be so wedded to the men in their lives.
You know what?
It's
really interesting that you say that, because the minute that you talked about being the friend that everybody comes and tells their secrets to, I was immediately reminded of how Jane Austen was really kind of socially underestimated before she was a published author. And people describe her as having been this person who was just sort of quietly sitting and listening in the background. And then, you know, she sort of came out with this book that had all these observations about society. And I thought, well, if you're the friend that people tell their secrets to, that bodes really well for you.
I think so. It's a useful thing to have, you know, as a writer. Though, of course, oh my gosh, I would never tell my friends secrets. I would die. But the themes, you know, my goodness, no, I'm really careful, actually, because all my friends will be reading this book. I don't want anybody's stories in there. But luckily, sure, you know, it sparks off your imagination. That's the other thing about writers. We listen, but we also have these crazy brains that work, you know, 100 miles an hour all day thinking, what if, what if, what if? So the social aspect really fascinated me. And also, you know, I've been in a really interesting situation. I was a stay-at-home mother for 10 years. Then I worked full-time. Then I worked part-time. So I've kind of experienced all those stages. And I, you know, a lot of times people can be quite disparaging about, you know, the yummy mummies or the stay-at-home mothers or, you know, people not working. But I also found that a lot of these women did have, you know, great careers, great education, but the system that's set up, the work environments that we have are really very patriarchal, and those do not support women, mothers, continuing to work. And often these women had no choice but to give up their jobs. So really, I do not blame them at all, and I can see how difficult it is to leave behind a career that you loved. So that's another aspect that really I wanted to show, because I feel like sometimes people don't factor that in.
I agree. And there are some very sympathetic characters amongst the mothers. There are also some very unsympathetic characters amongst the mothers as well. I have to say, some of them really... I struggled with some of those characters. There were some uncomfortable, competitive people in there. I'm sure those are familiar. And again, that's also quite Austen-esque, I guess, as well, isn't it?
Yes. You always get the type A personalities. And you also get, you know, the people who were very type A at work as well, who then transfer that completely onto their poor children.
Yes, they do. We're going to take a little break there, and when we come back, we will talk a bit more about specifically financial infidelity as a topic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome back. We're talking to Alia Ali Afzal about financial infidelity and her new novel, Would I Lie to You? So could you give us a definition of financial infidelity? Because we've used this word a couple of times, but be great to get your take on what it actually is.
So I did quite a lot of research on this when I started writing the book, because I wanted to delve in this subject a bit more deeply as well. And I was really surprised to see two particular pieces of research. One was by a solicitors in the UK, which found that, you know, money worries were one of the biggest causes of relationship breakup and divorce. And the other one was by a bank in America, which found that people will, you know, do anything, go through every milestone in a marriage, in a relationship, you know, getting intimate, moving in together, meeting the in-laws, but never talk about money. And so it seemed to me that this was, you know, financial infidelity was an area that was easy to slip into because it was just never talked about.
Right.
And I think financial infidelity to me, it means keeping bad secrets, but in I think in general, objective terms, it probably means keeping any secrets. But there again, you have, you know, my take and what the objective take is, which is, again, shows you how complex a matter this is, because everyone will view it differently. So for me, it might be, you know, spending a lot of money, not telling my husband, having secret debt, doing what Pfizer did. To other people, it might just mean just having, you know, secret savings, a secret account. Or just not revealing how much you earn, or not telling somebody about a bonus that you got. Or for some people, it would even be, you know, splurging a little bit every month.
So
yeah, I think it's a big thing.
I think that that's very true. There's also sort of a fine line between just running your finances separate from your partner. I mean, I don't tell my husband everything that happens. If there is something that will affect us and our goals as a couple, or if I need something from him, or if he says there's something he needs from me, or we have some kind of change, of course, we'll talk about it. But if things are just kind of ticking along, you know, I run my, like I said, I run my finances quite separately from him. And I certainly wouldn't consider that to be any kind of financial infidelity. It's just that we don't have everything fully merged. So that's it. Yeah, it's interesting that there are sort of shades through this, right? It's something about...
It was really interesting because the other thing I was thinking about and I was talking to somebody about is, you know, is financial infidelity as bad as sexual infidelity? And again, when you look at sexual infidelity, you know, some people think kissing is being, you know, unfaithful, kissing somebody else. So, and there's a whole spectrum. And I found it was similar to this. But I think you make a really good point, because I think the infidelity part is when it affects you as a couple, you as a family, you know, where it's going beyond something you've agreed together. Because of course, you know, your personal finances are going to be your personal finances. And most people will have separate accounts or separate kind of financial lives that do not impact the family or each other, and be quite happy with that.
I think it's really important to have that open communication. And I certainly, if my husband wanted to ask me questions, I would answer those. And I think the same is true with him. There's no active covering up. I'm sure he would tell me everything if I wanted to sit down and go through what's happening with us. So that's fine. I think it's where there is some kind of, actively a secret, that, as you say, would I lie to you? Is there a lie to tell here? I think that's where perhaps one, at least one of the lines is crossed, as far as I'm concerned. It's interesting that we talk about secret savings and secret holding secret assets potentially. Because although that's a less obvious one, I read a blog post a few years ago by an accountant who worked together, unearthing sort of secret assets that are being hidden during divorce cases. And again, I think that's where there's a kind of where is that line? You know, you might think that secret savings are actually fine, and in some cases they might be, especially if you have a partner who's a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. spend happy. You want yeah. to kind of protect the family assets. But, mm-hmm. but, you know, hiding assets and hiding investments and savings mm. because you intend to divorce and you don't want your partner to get what's actually their fair share yeah. out of it is mm-hmm. a very different deal. So it's a complex issue here. Mm-hmm. What do you think about, so we're encouraged to really empathize with Faiza. This is a first person novel written from her perspective. Mm-hmm. And she has done something that I think a lot of people would really judge at the mm-hmm. outset. Mm-hmm. How do you go about creating empathy for a character who's done something that a lot of people would judge like that? And what do you think of the balance between having empathy with that character and then thinking that they need to take responsibility for what they've done and our empathy with mm-hmm. Tom? So let's talk about that just generally.
So this was one of the most difficult aspects in writing the book. I was really keen to make a real person mm. and a flawed person. And, you know, sometimes I do come across, leads, female leads in books, and they are almost saintly and they're perfect and everything is right and somebody's cheated them. And, you know, it's like we're immediately asked to be sympathetic. But, you know, I don't really know many saintly people. I'm not a saintly person. And I don't find them that interesting or real. And it was really important to make somebody real and nuanced. And I wanted to make a good person who had made a terrible mistake. So what fascinated me about writing this character is that, you know, she's not a victim of something somebody's done to her. She's a victim of her own actions. Yes. And she's brought all this on herself. And what I liked about her is, though, that she owned it and mm-hmm. she didn't blame anyone else. She did her very best to try to see if she can try and fix it.
What about Tom's reaction? Because Tom also is a flawed character and perhaps a character that we don't necessarily see, because he's it's quite a masculine fragility in a mm-hmm. funny kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, it's very understated, but it's also really devastating for Faiza. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about creating his character?
Yes, and I think similarly for Tom, although he was our hero, he had to be a flawed hero as well. And, you know, he had to have his issues. And I think what I wanted to show was the dynamics in the relationship, which changed once the, you know, as we were talking before, when Faiza had her own job and she had her own finances coming in, this was never really an issue because each of them was sort of managing it in the way they wanted. And also, you know, he had a job, everything was fine. It was only when these changes happened that these little cracks really came to the fore. And so Tom, as much as Faiza is influenced by the way she was brought up, you know, her modest upbringing and also her parents' situation and feelings around money, Tom was also, you know, influenced by his parents and the way, you know, never touch savings and this kind of control over money. So
yeah,
I think that, you know, really came to the fore. And I think sometimes it does happen that when you have the man as the breadwinner and the woman is home, I wanted to show that sometimes that there is a power balance. However much you love each other, however much the husband respects what the wife is doing, there is this really subtle shift
yeah.
of power. And I wanted to show that really with Tom, that it can sometimes even happen imperceptibly. Even that person might not realize what they're doing.
Yeah.
But it does happen.
And then you get this reversal and there's the combination of the power switch, but you also get the judgment from people who agree with that patriarchal system. You know, not everybody is a feminist.
No.
Not everybody is here for equality, and there are people who, and even some people who would consider themselves to be in favor of equality or say they are, if asked, they still hold those attitudes of judgment against anybody who goes against the sort of traditions or norms, and that judgment is there, right?
It's so true. And I, you know, as I said, I've experienced, you know, being a stay-at-home mother, working full-time, working part-time. When I was a stay-at-home mother by choice, and I think that's what I wanted to show as well, it's a choice. We can do, you know, what we want, and we should have that choice. A lot of people said to me, you know, you're wasting your degree, your experience. Did you do all that just to change nappies and stay at home? So there was judgment around that. Then when I was working, there was judgment around, how can you leave your children? You're such a bad mother. You're just focusing on your career. And we are so quick to bash mothers, to be honest. We are so quick to bash women for their choices. And you will always, and so because I've had all these experiences, I can really see it from all these perspectives that you can never get it right, to be honest.
I completely agree. The point is not to find the right way to be. The point is that there is no right way to be, and you're always off balance, and you're always sort of struggling to keep up in some way because you're not getting, you're not meeting the ideal. Speaking about sort of struggling to keep up or not meeting an impossible ideal, you touched on it already a little bit in this conversation, but I wanted to talk a bit about Pfizer's feelings about race and about fitting in, because this is also a really big factor in some of her choices. I thought that was really interesting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So Pfizer, you know, I wanted to, you know, the story is about Pfizer, who's a brown woman, but the story is not about her being a brown woman, if you see what I mean, because it's about a woman
spending
too much money and lying about it. However, you know, because she's a brown woman, there are certain experiences that she has that come with that identity. And I really didn't want to not show her full range of experience, because this is her life, this is who she is. And some of what she's going through now is affected by what she went through as a child. So, you know, those feelings of not fitting in, which may have been about race before, and ostensibly now is more about money. And yet, you know, on a very nuanced level, there are certain microaggressions that she comes across. Even in the supposedly, you know, very liberal kind of cosmopolitan society that she moves in. So I felt that was really important to show, because I think, you know, we think of racism as something very overt, of, you know, people shouting racist slurs or things like that. But it can be almost like even sometimes an unconscious bias. So I wanted to really display this for people who are not maybe aware of it. So, you know, one of Pfizer's friends, you know, is not actually aware of what's happening, and Pfizer has to tell her. So I thought it was important. And sometimes it is downright, you know, a racist attitude that's coming down in a posing as something else.
I felt like you're right. You've achieved what you wanted to achieve in this, in that it's more that her experiences contribute to this sense of, do I fit in, or a sort of wider sense of insecurity that then plays into being a factor in her other choices, rather than sort of Pfizer being a brown woman first, Pakistani descent first, and then being Pfizer. You know, she's Pfizer and she's happened to have these experiences, and they happen to, and race happens to be a factor in the experience she's had and has ongoing. So I definitely didn't think that you're not hitting us over the head with it. It's just kind of a factor
in there. It's part
of
her experience. And I think it's important because I didn't want to write about her and not reference, you know, her heritage. And I really also really wanted to show, you know, somebody who straddles two cultures really comfortably. So I think she has that, you know, she's bilingual. She has her Pakistani culture, she has her British culture, she has her English family with Tom, she's married to a white man. And, you know, this has been my experience as a British Pakistani woman myself, growing up in England. And yet I don't see a lot of this, to be honest, in literature or in media. And it's my experience, it's the experience of my family, a lot of my friends. And yet all we see are these very polarized realities, which is not always the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a really good insight into a very relatable family for anybody from any background. And that's, you know, we are all humans. So, of course, they're a relatable family because they're a family, right?
Yeah. And money, I tell you, honestly, it's so interesting. You know, my mom told me a story about, you know, this was set in the 50s, about a woman she knew who had borrowed money from a moneylender. And this was years ago, I think, in the 50s. And she had small children and her husband had a very important, prestigious job. And the moneylender started asking for the money back. And she was too ashamed of, you know, what it would do to her husband's reputation and what her husband would do. And my mom told me this, by the way, after I'd written the book. So she read my book and she said, this is what happened, that a story that I want to tell you about. And that poor woman, she committed suicide. And it was so horrendous. She had three small children. So I started to think, you know, this has been an issue, I think, across, you know, cultures, across time. It's an age-old thing, money.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You can go absolutely back through all sorts of stories and find how money becomes a source of conflict. But as you say, you know, it's that conflict is exacerbated when there are secrets. And that's I think, what is so fascinating about this. Is, you know, you're united in dealing with it as an issue if you are able to be open about it. But when you can't, when this taboo is there, you can't present a united front and make a plan together. And I love this, that the earlier attempts that Tom and Fizer make to try and work out a way of dealing with money together, those aren't necessarily effective because they haven't dealt with the stuff, right? They've got the baggage, each of them, and they haven't dealt with it. So they try and they're a bit inept early on.
And I think that's what fascinates me because, you know, and I think it's similar. I think of it sometimes even something like dieting, okay, or trying to lose weight. I mean, if you look at it, it's really simple, okay? You eat less, you eat certain things, you exercise. But it should be really, if you look at it rationally, it's a really straightforward equation. And with money, it's not a big deal. You sit down, you say, this is how much we have. These are our goals. This is how much we can spend. But it's never that simple. And you know, part of it, you know, my fascination with this topic and why I wrote about it in this book is, why is it so hard to talk about it? Why does all the research say that we hate talking about it? And why do I absolutely clam up if my husband says, you know, what was this thing, or how much did you spend on this thing? And I just do not want to say. I will change the subject. I will talk about anything else but that. So why is it, you know, why is it such a difficult thing for us?
Well, I mean, you know, we've touched on so many reasons here around control and identity and independence and whether or not you fit in and belong, and your ability to provide for your children, and your gender identity, and so many sort of areas that just tie in. Podcast's worth of content.
Oh my gosh, yes, absolutely. Because it's never about the money, you know. It's about being judged. It's about your identity. It's about, you know, so many things. Never just about the money.
I agree. I agree. So we like to wrap up the show with a bit of advice if we can for our listeners. So I'm hoping that you, in all of your research and all of your thinking around this, you came to some conclusions and perhaps you can give our listeners some tips or some of your thoughts around responding to financial infidelity, whether they are the person who is keeping a secret or if they are the person who has learned of a secret or suspect their partner may be keeping some kind of secrets around money. Any thoughts from you?
Well, yes. I mean, I think, you know, there is a sense of such a huge betrayal if you have been the one who's the victim, say, we'll call it a victim, at the receiving end of financial infidelity. There's shock, you know, there's that horrible thing of somebody lied to you. And that's why it's in the title as well, because really in a relationship, that's what it comes down to. You should be able to, in a relationship, you should be able to believe whatever the other person tells you. And this is a relationship in which there should not be lies. And, you know, it's the lies that are at the core of it, because they build up this distance, they build up a sense of betrayal, this sense of, you know, what else are you lying about? So it's a really, it's a big deal when, you know, somebody has lied to you about money. Because it's, again, it's not just about the money. And then, of course, there's the whole money aspect, you know, how it's going to impact your life. It can do, it can in severe circumstances, like in Faiza's circumstances, impact everything in your life, affect your children, affect everything. And then on the other side, you know, the person has huge guilt, mostly, unless you're, you know, completely unempathetic person, you will have huge guilt. You will carry this around. This will cause you immense stress. You will be afraid to be caught out. You will feel bad about what you've done to your significant other. So there is a lot of emotion there. And so I think that emotion needs to be, you know, worked on in a way. And I would really recommend something like counseling, really, and sitting down with another person to work through the emotional aspects of this. Because I think it's a lot to deal with yourself. Of course, it depends on the severity. In terms of, you know, if it's not that bad and it's, you know, something that you've been feeling guilty about, it hasn't gone out of control, then I do suggest, you know, there's nothing for it. You have to sit down and talk. And it's how you do it. So for us, honestly, writing this book really did help, talking about the plot lines. And I can tell you that we are talking about that much more than we ever did. And it's taken away the emotional aspects of it, because in a way, you know, it's not about us. It is, but it isn't, because we're discussing our issues and our reticence about talking about money through this couple, this fictional couple in my book. So talk about it in a way that is not judgmental, that is not accusatory, although it's hard. So, I mean, I would say to my husband, you know, you can't say anything bad to me. You can't be angry with me. I'm going to tell you this stuff and you have to promise me you're not going to. And bless him, he does try. At least he doesn't say anything. And then I think that's how you need to do it. It's, it's, you know, it's disentangling the emotion from the actual facts, the practical stuff.
I think that that's it, isn't it? It's trying to pull those two things apart and say, we'll deal with the factual when we're ready, and we'll talk about the emotions, you know, that come up with as much kindness as we can towards each other and as much understanding. And actually, so this is something that my therapist used to say, is anger is a bid for understanding. And that somebody who is angry often feels misunderstood. And so actually, if you can approach conflict with curiosity, that can often be quite a good way of negating some of the tension, taking some of the sting out of things. But it's really hard. It is, it's really, really hard.
It is hard. But it feels so good, you know, when you do it. I think one has to remember that it's, you know, it's also very hard and painful and stressful to carry these secrets around. And when you can do it, it's the most amazing feeling. So it's like short-term stress for long-term, you know, stress-free life. So you got to you got to attack it and approach it. And I really would recommend everybody. And honestly, if I can do it, because I'm the biggest secret keeper when it comes to money, anybody can do it. If you have to write a novel to do it, do write a novel to do it.
I love that. I love that. It's been so great having you on the show. There's been so much insight and interest coming out of this. I really loved it. Where can our listeners find you if they want to learn more?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter. You can find me at AAA is writing. And I'm also on Instagram, which is my full name, Alia Ali Afzal Author. So I'm both those places, and I do talk about money, and I do talk about lies and secrets as well. So
awesome. Amazing. We also will put a link to the book in the show notes so people can click through and order this. It is a bookshop.org affiliate link. So a little bit of the money will go to support the show, and it also goes to support independent bookstores. So basically it's just a win-win-win. So please do go and check that out. We'll also put links to your social profiles in there as well. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Alia.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our talk.
You've been listening to Squanderlust, the podcast about the emotional side of money with me, Martha Lawton. If you've enjoyed the show, please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love one of those nice 5-star reviews too. Or you can tell a friend about us, maybe somewhere on social media where we're at SquanderlustPod. You can also find us at SquanderlustPod.com, where we put show notes, useful links and ways to support the show. Squanderlust is sponsored by Wardour Studios in Fitzrovia, London, with production by David Smith, Alicia Cunningham, Charlie Brandon King and Tom Berry. Our theme music is by Wardour Studios and graphic design by Jason Reed.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.